This is VOA News via remote. I'm Michael Brown. So far, demonstrations across the U.S. seem peaceful, mostly. Late Tuesday night, past curfews in several cities over the police killing of a handcuffed black man by kneeling on his neck. Two autopsies ruled George Floyd's death was a homicide. The disturbing incident was captured on video in Minneapolis, Minnesota last week. In New York, police detained several people after some demonstrators ignored orders to move along. Similar demonstrations are taking place here in Washington, where yesterday police fired tear gas to move protesters from near a church not far from the White House, where the president appeared moments later, raising a Bible in his hand. Outrage is growing across the globe at the death of George Floyd. The European Union's top diplomat said in Brussels that Floyd's death resulted from an abuse of power. Thousands marched to downtown Sydney, Australia's largest city, with more protests planned for Paris and elsewhere in France, along with a demonstration in The Hague in the Netherlands. Kenya's opposition leader and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga said he was praying that there be justice and freedom for all human beings who call America their country. And Chinese officials are criticizing the U.S. government's response to anti-racism protests across the country that have descended into violence. Chinese officials comparing the U.S. unrest to the pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong and call racial discrimination in the U.S. a persistent social ill. The death of George Floyd has led Chinese officials to champion the rights of America's ethnic minorities. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News. Confusion, missing mail-in ballots, and long lines at some polling centers marred primary elections Tuesday in 9 states and the District of Columbia, the biggest test yet of voting during the coronavirus outbreak. The most extensive balloting since the pandemic sparked lockdowns in mid-March served as a dry run for the November 3rd general election. It offered a glimpse of the challenge ahead on a national scale if that vote is conducted under a lingering threat of COVID-19. President Trump and former President Joe Biden easily won their primary races in Indiana, Rhode Island, Maryland, New Mexico, and the night's biggest prize, Pennsylvania. Biden also won South Dakota. Mexico moved into the second day of its reopening Tuesday as national officials warned the capital remains at maximum risk for COVID-19 after 2 months of restrictions to slow the spread of the virus. The government will still require everyone to wear face masks, but social distancing is now only recommended. Mexico City will reopen some sections of public parks Tuesday, and people must wear masks and maintain a healthy distance apart. Zoos and playgrounds will remain closed along with restaurants. Mexico City, the epicenter of the coronavirus in Mexico, has confirmed more than 20,000 coronavirus cases and more than 2,000 deaths so far. An advocacy group backed by the tech industry filed a lawsuit on Tuesday against President Trump's executive order on social media. A U.S. technology companies have been fighting the White House efforts to weaken a law that protects them. The proposed legislation was part of an executive order Trump signed on Thursday afternoon. Trump had attacked Twitter for tagging his tweets about unsubstantiated claims of fraud about mail-in voting, with a warning prompting readers to fact-check the post. The White House has declined to comment on the lawsuit. An international donor secured pledges of just over $1 billion for war-torn Yemen at a virtual funding conference Tuesday, but is only about half what the United Nations says is needed to meet needs for this year. UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock said Yemen is now on the cliff, below which lies a tragedy of historic proportions. The UN said $2.4 billion necessary for critical programs through the end of the year. That includes $108 million for the COVID-19 response. For more news, please join us, voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate, Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 3rd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. A high court says South Africa's COVID-19 lockdown regulations are unconstitutional.
We were totally overwhelmed by the fact that our High Court agreed with us that the lockdown regulations were totally unconstitutional and invalid.
Reno De Beer is the president and co-founder of the Liberative Fighters Network. Kenyan police have killed a total of 15 people since the beginning of coronavirus lockdown. Malawi COVID-19 cases rise as its citizens are being repatriated from South Africa. And politics is getting too personal in Malawi as President Mutharika is accused of making sexist remarks to a former female president.
Our organization believes that the statements that were made by President Mutharika were completely uncalled for and are a setback for politics in general, particularly for women in politics.
Ulemu Hannah Kanyangolo is a member of the Young Feminist Network in Malawi, and a recent attack in Western Niger sends more than 1,000 people fleeing. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. High Court says South Africa's COVID-19 lockdown regulations are unconstitutional and therefore invalid. In his ruling on Tuesday, Judge Norman Davis said the government gave little or no regard to the impact of the lockdown regulations on the constitutional rights of South Africans. The Liberty Fighters Network and the Hola Bona Renaissance Foundation had challenged the constitutionality of the lockdown. The judge ordered the government to republish the regulations with consideration on the impact of those regulations on the rights of individual South Africans. Reno De Beer is the president and co-founder of the Liberty Fighters Network. He says his organization welcomes the judge's ruling.
We were totally overwhelmed by the fact that our High Court agreed with us that the lockdown regulations promulgated in South Africa were totally unconstitutional and invalid. We've had so many people complaining to our organization how they have been negatively affected by the lockdown. And unfortunately, in a country like South Africa, which is regarded as a wonderful human rights haven in the world, to see how our constitution has been violated by our lockdown regulations, it's a very sad day in South Africa as well. But we can still rely on our judiciary.
I'm sure when the South African government issued the coronavirus lockdown, it was taking into consideration the well-being of the people of South Africa.
What our government forgot was that Africa and South Africa are totally different from the situation in Europe and in the United States of America. Our socioeconomic circumstances are much, much different, and we were not in a position to have followed suit after first world countries. We are a developing nation, and as a result, our situation should have been much better thought through. We forget that we are Africans. We can face the worst diseases like Ebola and malaria and cholera and HIV/AIDS, but we never had lockdowns for that. So yes, our government was maybe looking after our health, but at the end of the day, we believe that the lockdown caused much more harm than it was actually good.
What do you think the judge means or meant when he said that some of the lockdown regulations were irrational?
When the judge said that the decisions were irrational, he basically meant that it was not thought through. Our government reacted to international reaction to the COVID-19 disease. We should have had to react towards our own research that we'd done about the case and not just follow suit. For example, our lockdown regulations specified that we were not allowed to go and visit your grandfather, for example, on his deathbed. That is how far our regulations went, and that was a total abuse of our basic human rights. And for Africans who know the Freedom Charter of the 1950s, which founded the democracy in South Africa, one would realize that the Freedom Charter have been totally abused by this government of ours now.
Reno De Beer is the president and co-founder of the Liberty Fighters Network of South Africa. He was speaking with us from Pretoria. Malawi is seeing a surge in COVID-19 cases as citizens return from South Africa, the country hit hardest on the continent. Hundreds of returnees are expected to arrive in Malawi this week, raising fears that the figures will rise even more. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Out of nearly 1,000 Malawian migrant workers who recently came home, 134 tested positive, almost doubling the country's total cases. Malawi started registering a rise in COVID-19 cases on Thursday, a few days after the return of a group of migrant workers who had been stranded in South Africa because of a coronavirus lockdown. Of the 102 cases confirmed Thursday, 92 were among returnees, the highest number of new cases in a single day since Malawi confirmed its first case on April 2. The trend continued this week. The Presidential Task Force on COVID-19 said out of 52 cases confirmed Monday, 42 were from people who have just returned from South Africa. And in a more alarming development, about 400 returnees escaped last week from a stadium where they were being held in a quarantine. Officials are concerned the escapees will spread the virus when they go back to their rural areas where most of them live. Dorothy Ngoma is the former president of Malawi's National Organization of Nurses and Midwives. She told VOA that it's time for Malawian political leaders and clergy to help teach people about ways to prevent the virus from spreading.
We must go house to house. And I want to encourage UTM, Malay Congress, DPP, whatever party, the chiefs, the churches, to continue doing this 24 hours a day until we make sure that everybody understands.
Critics blame the government for failing to enforce anti-coronavirus measures, which include social distancing, use of face masks, and closing borders to prevent imported coronavirus. Speaking on live television Monday, President Peter Mutharika said his administration has tried to contain the spread of the virus, but politics has undermined those efforts. The country is preparing for a June 23 presidential election.
Our fight against coronavirus is being undermined by politics and politicians. The courts stopped us from going on a lockdown. The same courts went on to go to an election. Now, we have a situation that encourages everybody to campaign and undermine social distancing.
Mutharika, who later in the day conducted a political rally, said it is now up to Malawians to choose between fighting coronavirus and going to an election. A survey released this week about public perception of COVID-19 has shown that 82% of Malawians are more scared of hunger than being infected with coronavirus. Boniface Dulan is the research director at the Institute for Public Opinion and Research, which conducted the survey.
Our findings, interestingly enough, also show that Malawians are actually supportive that the election should be held, notwithstanding the risk of coronavirus. So this actually has basically made people think that maybe social distancing is not the best way to fight the coronavirus, which is really dangerous in itself.
Health experts have warned that the ongoing political rallies, coupled with the return of people from South Africa, puts Malawi at a higher risk of more COVID-19 cases in the near future. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
In Malawi, the Human Rights Defenders Coalition is calling on the United Nations to remove President Peter Mutharika as ambassador for the He for She global campaign, which is intended to defend and protect the dignity and rights of women and girls. This after President Mutharika reportedly and allegedly made a sexist remark about former Malawian President Joyce Banda. The president reportedly referred to Mrs. Banda as a hule, which some say literally means a prostitute. Mrs. Banda, whose party is part of the opposition coalition, which is challenging President Mutharika in the coming July 2nd presidential election rerun, reportedly said during a televised campaign speech that President Mutharika was a binge alcoholic. Ulemu Hana Kanyongolo is a member of the Young Feminist Network of Malawi.
Our organization, the Young Feminist Network, believes that the statements that were made by President Mutharika were completely uncalled for and are a setback for politics in general, particularly for women in politics. As the president, he's expected to uphold the constitution, which provides for gender equality, as well as many protections of civil and political rights. In addition to that, he's also a he for she champion under UN Women. So it's definitely a several steps back in the advancement of gender equality, and it's also a deterrent to other women who would like to participate in politics for fear that if anything happens, then their rights will be violated or things will be said about them that have nothing to do with their work or actual politics, but just go towards discrediting them in a way that is not issue-based. It's just derogatory.
Some Malawians are saying, well, former President Joyce Banda was the first to criticize President Mutharika, I think referring to the president literally as a drunkard or a binge drinker or alcoholic. So in that respect, they say that's why President Mutharika made the comment. What do you think of that?
Yes, some people have justified President Mutharika's comments by saying that Dr. Joyce Banda had said something previously and that he was merely retaliating. But I think that it's a very backward way of thinking and of doing politics to resort to name-calling or to shy away from the issues that actually matter, the issues that are to do with the development of the country or that are relevant to politics in general or the elections.
The Human Rights Defenders Coalition is calling on the United Nations to remove President Mutharika as ambassador for the He for She global campaign. Do you think that this is warranted?
I absolutely agree, because his comments, they are completely in contradiction with his role that is meant to play as a he for she champion. A he for she champion is meant to be a man who is fighting for the rights of women, who is protecting, promoting, and respecting the rights of women. And it's evident that by calling Dr. Joyce Banda what he did, that there is utter disregard for the respect, promotion, and protection of the rights of women, because that is not the behavior that is meant to be displayed by he for she champion.
Malawians are supposed to be going to the polls July 2nd or June 23rd, whichever date is approved. What do you make of the tune of the campaign so far? I mean, is it becoming too personal?
I do believe that the campaign is personal, because many comments have been made by several politicians from all camps, which, as I previously said, aren't necessarily issue-based. And instead of, at this critical time, especially given the dire condition that Malawi is in economically, socially, instead of talking about important issues to do with our development or the protection of the rights of certain groups of people in this country, some politicians have resorted to name-calling and to talking about things that are just not relevant. It's not a good example, particularly for the youth who are aspiring to join politics, because now it's looking like it's a mudslinging game. And I think that it would be better if the campaign was such that people focused on the issues that actually matter for the development of the country, as opposed to making personal attacks or making derogatory, inflammatory statements.
Ulemu Hana Kanyongolo is a member of the Young Feminist Network of Malawi. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 3rd. At least 15 people have died and 31 others injured by Kenyan police since the country imposed dusk to dawn curfew as one of the security measures to curb the spread of COVID-19. The Kenyan Independent Policing and Oversight Authority says about 87 complaints, which include deaths, shootings, harassment, assault, robbery, inhumane treatment, and sexual assault, are currently being investigated by authorities. As Maureen Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, Kenyans took to the streets on Tuesday protesting the police killing of a homeless man on Monday night in Nairobi.
In an investigation by the Independent Policing and Oversight Authority, the reports indicate that the 15 deaths and 31 incidents where victims sustained injuries have directly been linked to actions of police officers' brutality during the curfew enforcement. Yesterday, Tuesday, Kenyans in Nairobi took to the streets protesting the killing of a homeless man who was shot by police officers who were patrolling during curfew hours in Mathare slums, Nairobi. A protester, Etienne Mashuli, a Rwandan-American living in Kenya, speaking during the protest outside the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, said that police brutality is a global problem violating human rights.
There is a clear linkage between white supremacism and the problems, particularly police brutality and dictatorships that are going on across Africa. Many of the dictators that make our lives brutal and unlivable are funded by U.S. taxpayer money. We are here to express that solidarity with the American people, but to also say that white supremacy is a cancer that is also affecting us.
Kenya's Director of Public Prosecution, Nurdin Haji, said his regional and county offices are playing the oversight role on excessive use of force by police on Kenyans while chanting Black Lives Matter. The demonstrators, who included Kenyans and Americans, called for accountability from the U.S. Embassy in law enforcement both in Kenya and U.S. A U.S. citizen, Amelia Hopkins, said that American police and police from other countries should stop extrajudicial killings.
A woman from the U.S., and it is my responsibility to be speaking up against what is happening right now to Black people around the world, but especially in the country I come from. We want to send out to the world the message that as Kenyans, as U.S. Americans in Kenya, as other foreigners in Kenya, that we are not going to stand for police brutality. We're not going to stand for the way the U.S. funds Black Lives Matter.
In a statement addressed to the U.S. ambassador to Kenya, the protesters raised concerns over the inappropriate police actions and called on leaders to change policing in Kenya. A protester, James Karioke, criticized the Kenyan police over extrajudicial killings and use of unnecessary force while enforcing COVID-19 rules.
We are here to say that there is a connection between police brutality in the United States and police brutality in Africa, and in particular in Kenya, in the wake of the COVID crisis.
The rules by the government of Kenya imposed on Kenyans have seen many people suffer in the hands of the police and no justice served as the number of COVID-19 cases increased drastically. Yesterday, Tuesday, Kenya recorded 72 more COVID-19 cases, bringing the total to 2,093. Two more people succumbed to the virus, raising the death toll to 71, as recoveries stand at 499. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Demolition of Accra's iconic Jamestown fishing community began late last month to construct a China-funded multi-million-dollar fishing harbor. Local authorities pulled down over 300 temporary and permanent structures, including businesses, a school, and places of worship in a largely poor, densely populated area. While many are excited about the prospect of development, the demolition has also raised fears for already precarious livelihoods. Stacey Nutt reports from Accra.
Rubble is all that's left from a brightly coloured playground in Accra's Jamestown fishing community that children once enjoyed before it was demolished in May. The demolition by a Chinese government-funded project fulfills years of promises by authorities to upgrade the harbour. Through their NGO, Na Boko Kwate and her husband Emmanuel fed and supported local children in sports, education, arts and child rights. They also offered skills training and housed about 50 children. The J&E Streetwise Foundation had previously been told it would be excluded from demolition.
These are children whose, some of them, their parent is out for them, because this community, we don't have any work or a job for these women. They come here, they hustle to get food. Some of these kids stay the whole day without even food. So we are here supporting the community.
However, with very short notice, its buildings and playground disappeared. The fishing community has been a tourist attraction for years. People came to see the local fishing culture, brightly coloured canoes and women smoking fresh catch at the waterfront. Tour guide Colin Seymour-Smith, who also runs a community theatre, worries about the future and for those who have lived here for generations and have nowhere to.
This is the biggest development happening in Gamashi, or Jamestown to be precise. So for me, it's good, but how they went about it, that is the issue.
Abdul Razak Aloti's home was among those demolished. So he set up a makeshift home in the rubble. Out of work because of the coronavirus pandemic, he hopes he can get a job at the new harbour project.
I think it will help me with my family. So if they say they are coming to do it, we like it. But I don't think they have anything to do here and they come and just demolish our buildings.
Ghana authorities say they will compensate those with legal claims to lost property and are temporarily relocating fishermen along the coast as the harbour is built, says Seth Raymond-Tete, a chairman for the local assembly.
When the fishing harbour is constructed, it is going to boost the economic life in this community. And that is what will change the life of a lot of people in the community. So we are looking at something that is going to benefit a lot of people than looking at one or two people that it has affected them today.
The project is expected to take about 32 months to complete and will include a school, fish processing facilities, offices, a market and cold storage. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
In the Gambia, land officials are appealing for calm. This follows intercommunal land dispute, leading to violent confrontation among the locals, including the police. As Pandere Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, Gambia's land officials have warned citizens to stop illegally encroaching on state-designated lands.
Land dispute is becoming common in the Gambia. State-designated lands are being illegally occupied by communities, according to Buba Sanyang, a permanent secretary at the Ministry of Lands.
In the Lemasu layout, the whole of the cemetery, as the council is indicating, has been encroached and occupied by people.
Occasionally, the government would issue eviction notices to people it accused of illegally occupying state lands. Failure to move out will result to one's property being demolished by the state.
We cannot allow such to continue where government create a layout, create a public space, and then people take the law into their own hands and then just occupy those public spaces for their personal interests.
Under Gambian law, all lands belong to the state. Therefore, land officials have been calling on citizens to avoid buying lands from unauthorized officials or landowners. Kemeseng Sane is a Gambian political analyst. Sane is not happy with the way the government handles the country's land crisis.
On the side of the government, I would say that they are not handling the issue with care and with maturity and sincerity.
The government has set up a land commission which is empowered by law to resolve land dispute-related cases in the country. But Sane is of the view that the government is not giving the land commission the support it deserves.
I spoke to them, the commission, to do my own fact-finding, to find out that they have not even sat with the Minister of Local Government to assess so far, or to even the Minister of Local Government to give them at least a gist of the lands in this country and where they are confronting these land issues and the other things, so that they can work hand in glove to make sure that they remedial the situations of land dispute in this country.
Sane warns that if the current land crisis is not sorted out, the country is likely going to face a major land dispute unrest.
I want the government to come with a correct policy in terms of land ownership in this country. And not only it has to be at the executive level, but it has to be at the grassroots level.
For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandere by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
And that's it for this Wednesday, June 30 edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti saying have a good day.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with our voices on VOA.